I'd like to call the meeting in the Senate Special Committee on Trans-Alaska Pipeline System Throughput to order. Let the record reflect that it is 15:35 on Tuesday, February 5th, 2013. We are in the Butchovich Room 205. Let the record show we have a quorum to do business. Present are Co-Chair Dunleavy, Senator McGuire, Senator Fairclough, Senator Gardner, and myself, Chairman Machicki. Also like to note the presence of Senator Giesel. Didn't see any other elected officials in the room right now. Thank you for being here, Senator. I'd like to recognize our committee staff, Nancy Jones from Senate Records, LAO staff Stephanie Gavin, and operating camera today is Lisa Fu. I'd like to also please remind everyone to turn off your cell phone. Purpose of our meeting today is to have presentation from industry on Senate Bill 21, the Oil and Gas Production Tax Bill. And today we'll be hearing from several organizations, AOGA, Alyeska Pipeline, Little Red Services, and ConocoPhillips. We're going to begin with AOGA. If Kara Moriarty can please join us, identify yourself for the record, and begin your testimony at will.
Thank you, Senator. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. AOGA is the professional trade association that represents our 16-member companies who account for the majority of oil and gas exploration, development, production, transportation, refining in Alaska, both onshore and offshore. These comments regarding Senate Bill 21 have been reviewed by all of our member companies and have been approved unanimously. Senate President Senator Charlie Huggins outlined the Senate's priorities in an opinion piece published last week in the Anchorage Daily News on Thursday, January 31st. In it, he stated, I quote, "The most pressing issue facing Alaska is the downturn in oil production on Alaska's North Slope. We couldn't agree more. In fact, that is why this committee was formed, to investigate the causes of oil production decline and make recommendations to turn the tide. So we applaud Senator Huggins, you, the committee, and Governor Parnell and others for recognizing that this is such a serious issue. You have seen this chart over and over, but I think it's important to reflect on how serious our production decline really is. When I was legislative staff in the year 2000, which is the first year in this chart, no one was talking about production decline in the building at that time. Instead, everyone was focusing on price, because even though we had 1 million barrels per day of production, prices hovered between $8 to $10 that year, and the state was facing a $1 billion shortfall at a time when the budget was much less than it is today. This chart is the most recent forecast from the Department of Revenue, and you will see that they've employed a new risk modeling into their forecast. In the past, this is the chart from 2012, the 2012 forecast. You will see that just last year, they were projecting 10 years from now that 50% of our production would be from new oil, or the section in yellow. But because of the risk modeling, you will see that now new oil 10 years from now is projected to only be about 15% or so of our total production. And while we applaud the Department of Revenue for providing a more likely and realistic projection, it is important to note that their forecast for currently producing fields, which is the blue section of the forecast, assumes that the current levels of investment in producing fields will continue, which is by no means guaranteed. But regardless, the fact is Alaska's production decline rate has remained at about 6% per year for the last decade, or about 40,000 barrels per day per year. While we have never said that oil production will return to historic levels of 2 million barrels per day, we continue to argue that this accelerated decline is unacceptable, especially at a time of record and sustaining high oil prices over the last 5 years. And just how is our competition reacting to high oil prices? This slide you've seen, I'm sure, several times as well, but it shows the oil price in the green dotted line and production from other regions. Alaska is in the blue, and it includes other mature basins like ours. Production in Texas, as you can see, started to level off as prices increased in the 2000s, and this was before the shale explosion. And of course, I don't need to remind this committee about how North Dakota, on the bottom, has now surpassed us in production. But another state is about to surpass us as well, and that is California. As this slide says, we are headed out of metal contention. We barely have the bronze and are about to slip to the fourth largest producing state in the United States. In fact, we now supply only 8% of the nation's oil production. I shared similar statistics with you at our legislative luncheon last week or a couple weeks ago, but I think they bear repeating. In November 2012, which is the most recent month of statistics from the U.S. Energy Information Agency, production in Texas was about 2.1 million barrels per day, North Dakota was 731,000 barrels per day, Alaska, in third, was 553, and California, nipping at our heels, was 533,000 barrels per day. And this is at a time when we still have world-class resources. As you know, I represent a diverse membership, ranging from companies exploring and operating in Cook Inlet and on the North Slope, to companies hoping to develop the Arctic Outer Continental Shelf, to three in-state refineries, and our lifeline, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, commonly referred to as TAPS. Current production is over 100,000 barrels per day less than when TAPS was originally started in 1977. So one company in particular who would love to see more oil in the pipeline is Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. And this slide is incorrect. I will point out I found the updated statistics and didn't have time to change the slide. So it is 8% of our nation's domestic oil production is through TAPS. Because of the dedication and efficiency of Alyeska's employees, we don't hear about the increasing day-to-day demands and challenges Alyeska faces in providing safe and reliable transportation of our resources to market. But you are going to hear more about that in detail from the president of Alyeska following my testimony. But it's not just Alyeska. Every single one of my member companies shares your concern about the decline in TAPS, and for good reason. Two of the three in-state refineries rely solely on North Slope crude, delivered through TAPS for their refineries. And it is no secret the challenges the refineries face in Alaska. Low throughput has increased the costs of refining, especially in the interior. For example, about 20 years ago, the oil when it reached North Pole refineries was about 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Today, it comes in the mid-30 degree range. So, in the refining process, they need to heat the oil to 600 degrees Fahrenheit. Because the interior refineries are expending considerably more energy to heat the oil an extra 70 degrees due to the drop in throughput, it is no secret, and it's no secret, that the cost of energy is extremely high in the interior. So that has made the refining industry, especially in the interior, extremely challenged. And even though my members in Cook Inlet may seem far removed from this issue, successful operations on the North Slope affect their businesses as well. As skilled workers, especially those with drilling experience, have left Alaska for areas that are booming, now that Cook Inlet is starting to boom again, it has been extremely challenging for those Cook Inlet companies to get drilling equipment and workers back to the inlet. As we look to the next generation of oil and gas development, the Arctic OCS is believed to contain about 27 billion barrels of oil and over 130 TCF of natural gas. But even if we have a successful exploration season in 2013, production will be 12 to 15 years before we see production in TAPS from the Chukchi Sea. Our pipeline needs to be healthy and viable then, as well as today, and the time in between. My remaining member companies are exploring, producing, and operating on the North Slope. these producers of the existing non-legacy fields on the slope and the developers of any new fields that may be discovered need as much production as possible flowing from the legacy fields through TAPS in order to keep the costs affordable to ship their oil from the slope to its refinery destinations. Unaffordable, high transportation costs could cripple the economics of any new fields that might be found, as well as economics of non-legacy fields currently in production. We used this analogy last year during testimony, but it still rings true. The North Slope Oil Province is like a tree, with the two great legacy fields being its trunk, and with the other fields being branches rising out of the trunk. If one peels the bark off all the way around the trunk and makes it unhealthy, all the other branches will become unhealthy too, no matter how robust they might have been if the trunk stayed strong. Governor Parnell recognizes that as a state, we need increased oil production from all fields because the current throughput is unacceptable. He has identified four key principles, which we've all heard several times, that any tax reform must be fair to Alaskans. Second, it must encourage new production. Third, it must be simple and restore balance. And fourth, it must be durable for the long term. AOGA endorses these principles. And as you work through this bill in this committee and the remaining committees as we go through the process, we also encourage you to ask yourselves, what is the state's goal and desired outcome? Does the state's policy reflect the constitutional mandate of developing the natural resources here for the maximum benefit of Alaskans both today and tomorrow? Is the policy short, mid, or long term? Will it encourage additional investments across a wide spectrum of projects and companies? Will it encourage development through a fair and predictable regulatory environment? And will it encourage development through land sales and competitive lease sales? The challenge facing Alaska is not having too many companies pursuing opportunities that they see here, but in having too few. To be effective, any reform measure needs to avoid tax changes that artificially create winners and losers. So moving to Senate Bill 21. Senate Bill 21 takes some positive steps towards the goal of more production, such as the gross revenue exclusion concept and eliminating progressivity. There are some other provisions that need further consideration in order to fully achieve the goals set out in this legislation. So one, we support the elimination of progressivity. We do have reservations with what the bill proposes for tax credits. Most importantly, the proposed repeal of tax credits for the qualified capital expenditure, commonly referred to as the QCE. The trade-off between repealing progressivity and losing the QCE credit is not beneficial to industry with a rising cost structure, which you heard about last week from PFC Energy, and a low price environment, although it would be helpful in high oil prices. We strongly support the GRE, or the gross revenue exclusions, concept, but we do have concern over the limited applicability to new fields only, which is further compounded by the loss of QCE credits as a driver for additional investment. We believe the GRE and tax credit restructuring proposed in the bill could and should be expanded and better tailored to fit the majority of projects for legacy fields that would increase the amount of oil and gas from them. We also believe the reasons that led the state to create the small producer tax credit under AS43.55.024 are still valid, and we are pleased to see the administration recognize that in the bill by extending this credit from 2016 to 2022. But the reasons for creating the exploration tax credits under AS43.55.025 are also still valid today, and the bill would be improved by extending these tax credits or making them permanent. On the topic of credits, similarly, the bill would also be improved by addressing the upcoming end of the tax caps in Cook Inlet production and non-Cook Inlet gas sold for in-state use, which will otherwise occur at the end of 2021. Addressing these known issues now, before they become imminent, would strengthen the durability of the reform tax. The members of AOGA desire the same outcome that you and the governor and Alaskans want. We want more oil in the pipeline, providing a solid future for our industry and continued revenues to the state to the maximum benefit of all Alaskans. Our member companies want to do business in Alaska. Some have been exploring and producing here for decades, while others have arrived more recently. Both groups, both the long-term companies and the new companies, have a strong desire to be able to remain in Alaska long-term for the mutual benefit of their own and the state. So overall, we believe the bill provides a cornerstone for significant and crucial tax reform. It will take a monumental effort just to replace oil from declining fields with a mixture of new production and new stimulation to legacy fields and bring the decline to a stop. We need it all. So AOGA stands ready and willing to work with this committee, future committees, the entire legislature, the governor, and Alaskans to set a long-term policy for the future of our state. So we all need to work together to make this happen, and we stand ready to do so. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Moriarty. I just have one comment. You know, what I have to say is everyone I've spoken to in this 28th legislature shares concern about the decline of throughput. And that's why this committee was formed, and we're looking at Senate Bill 21 at throughput issues. We're not dealing necessarily with the tax issues. We're looking at how it could affect throughput and if there are suggestions that can improve the bill. But we know there are two philosophies in this state. There's a philosophy of folks that believe we can reduce production decline, and there are folks that believe that arresting the decline is unlikely and are concerned that without guarantees that it's essentially a giveaway of state revenue. How can we ensure for Alaskans that the probability of increasing throughput in TAPS is not only a probability, but a relatively high probability if we were to become more competitive?
Well, I think, thank you, Chairman Machicki. I think we just need to look at other regions. We are not competitive when you look at our tax structure compared to other regions that have been able to increase their production, even though they are old declining fields. So I think, you know, in response to Alaskans that asked that question, what kind of policy does Alaska want? Do they want a policy where they have more production over the long term or to take as much as they can in the short term? And we would argue that you can have more production over the long term if you have a competitive environment. And I think all you need to do is look at other regions as evidence of that.
Okay. Yes, sir. Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, I just want to make sure that I heard correctly. Were you proposing that the committee look at rolling Cook Inlet into this concept?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, thank you for the opportunity to clarify. We are very supportive of the fact that this bill has left Cook Inlet harmless and has left the tax structure in Cook Inlet alone. However, if the bill was to look at in tax credits, there are a few tax credits in Cook Inlet that are set to expire in 2021 that we think if it's a good policy now, it would be a good policy to either extend or make permanent, and that it would be better to make those changes now versus right before the deadline because companies make investment decisions years out. And so we would just advocate that if you're going to look at changing the tax credit structure, that you think about incorporating that one piece of Cook Inlet. Otherwise, our membership is very happy with being left alone.
And just to clarify, the mandate of the committee is to look at caps, North Slope centric issues at this point. Okay, thank you.
Other questions, comments? Well, Ms. Moriarty, I want to, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, you are.
With
yes.
A name like Machicki, I'm sensitive to that. I want to thank you very much for your testimony, and I assume you'll be available for committee questions even after the meeting. So
I will.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Next, to testify from Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, Admiral Barrett, President of Alyeska Pipeline. If you can please introduce yourself for the record and proceed as you see fit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Tom Barrett. I'm the president of the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company with the operator of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. I have with me Michelle Egan, so I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about declining throughput. The steady decline in oil production on the North Slope is a crucial issue for us as the pipeline operator, and it's a critical issue for the good people of this state, who I think will face long-term adverse impacts if that decline continues.
Could you give us just a moment? Sure. Let's take a brief at ease. Okay.
Okay. I'm getting the reverb when I talk.
We're back in session. Mr. Tom Barrett, Admiral Barrett, President of Alyeska Pipeline. Proceed, sir.
Thank you, sir. As I said, this is a significant problem for us and for the state. I just wanted to give an example of how real it is, though. While this hearing goes on today, your pipeline production throughput will go down over 2,000 barrels in an hour and a half. Since the legislature has convened, your throughput has declined over 725,000 barrels. That's significant, and it's happening every day, even as we sit here. So TAPS, by way of background, is an 800-mile pipeline that runs from Prudhoe Bay to our marine terminal at Valdez. It was designed as a warm oil pipeline, and that's significant. It was set to move 1.5 million barrels a day, and it obviously, as you know, had a peak production of over 2.1 million barrels. But the circumstances have changed. Throughput and temperatures are declining. At 580,000 barrels a day, segments of crude oil in our pipe are below 32 degrees Fahrenheit during winter months. So it's not operating as it used to as a warm oil pipeline. It has so far delivered over $170 billion over the past 35 years to the state treasury. More than 90% of state government services in Alaska are paid for by oil revenue. Some experts suggest that without TAPS, Alaska's economy might be half of its present size, with all that implies about Alaskans' quality of life and the economic opportunities here. The current state fiscal structure depends primarily on oil, and will for the foreseeable future. Our design basis, as we said, was 1.5 million barrels a day. In calendar year 2012, our average daily throughput was 548,000 barrels, down 6%. And you can see this is a well-known slide, but it's been steady and it's on a continuous slope. If TAPS represents the economic engine of the state of Alaska, then its oil level is well below the dipstick ad oil line. And that's the reality. Declining flow increasingly challenges our outstanding personnel, and we run that line 7x24, 365 days a year, even as we sit here. This is the temperature profile of the line for the last 2 weeks. And as you can see, last week the oil was close to 32 degrees Fahrenheit. As it throughput declines, velocity down the pipe slows. That means the more time in the pipe, the more exposure to cold. And colder crude oil leads to increased ice and wax buildup. So what I wanted to point out on the slide, if you just look briefly, we like to be above 40 degrees in terms of risk management. And we work very hard to keep the line at that point. When we have severe cold in the interior, that's a big challenge for us right now.
Question for you, Mr. Barrett. Why is there warming between pump station 7 and 10?
Well, we add heat at pump station 7. That station was taken out of service several years ago. We brought it back in service, and we added recirculation capability to it. So we add heat probably on the order of 8 to 10 degrees by circulating the oil through the station. It costs us about $80,000 a day to do that. But we add heat there. The bumps you can see, we add heat recirculating at pump stations 3 and 4. We add heat at 7. We get heat from a North Pole refinery. That's the North Pole metering station there, so it bumps up again. We recirculate at pump station 9, and then we run on down the line to the marine terminal, and we pick up a small bit of heat just before the terminal from the refinery there. So the bumps are heat adds to the line as it flows down.
So in essence, the lower the operating or the lower the throughput, the more that Alyeska has to spend on energy to operate the line.
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Along those lines, excuse me, through the chair, you have to spend the money, but that cost is passed on to whom?
Well, it's passed on in terms of our operating costs to the tariffs, to the state, and to our owners, and ultimately recovered through the tariffs. But it's an operating cost of the system.
Okay. Thank you.
I wanted, from a pipeline operator point of view and the perspective of our people who are just terrific, to give you one example of why declining flow is increasingly challenging for us. So we use scraper pigs to clean wax out of the pipeline. And on the slide, you can see what a clean scraper pig looks like and what it looks like when we extract it at a receiving facility on the line. It's coated with wax. And cleaning the wax out of the line is essential to preventing corrosion, protecting our system integrity. Because of the declining flow, we've stepped up our pigging efforts. We send one down the line now every 6 to 10 days. But even with increased pigging, chunks of wax can damage valves, interfere with the technology that tells our folks where the pigs are located, and make our pigging more difficult to manage. And I just wanted to give you an example of this. On New Year's Day, many Alaskans were enjoying a holiday, perhaps watching a college bowl game. That's not what our crews at Pump Station 9 were doing. I was up there with them. And what we had was a pig trapped in the station piping where it normally goes through at the pump station. And the reason it got trapped there was because in front of the pig was an exceptionally dense cloud of wax. Our sensors tripped on the wax thinking it was the pig, but the pig was still behind it. So the pig became trapped. And if you think of what went on before that, externally, we had extremely cold temperatures in the interior, and we were adding pretty much every BTU of heat we could. And the consequence was we got a heavy, dense wax cloud that we had trouble managing, and that trapped the pig. So our people did a fabulous job of carefully managing that out. Hillary Schaefer, our supervisor up there, and her people, I watched them do it. It was careful. By the way, there was no interruption to throughput while we managed that. And keep that in mind. They managed that out without stopping that line. If it had been worse, We might have stopped the line because I'm not going to take the risk of oil in the ground. So they got it going on down the line. We cleared the wax, cleared the pig, got it on down the line to Valdez. And they do those kind of things, not that type of thing every day, but every day they're challenged to manage the implications of declining throughput. And I'm very proud of them, but they do a lot for us. What I also wanted to note is that adding heat will eventually not be good enough. Like I just, the example I gave you, the operational challenges are complex, and just adding more heat will not solve the problems in this line. Right now, we're devoting significant resources to study and test what we call cold dry flow. And that essentially means figuring out if we can remove water from the oil before it enters the pipeline. And as a result of that, run, because the cold, the risk is it creates ice, and run the line in a cold condition. And we're evaluating the science and the operational implications behind that. So it's possible that removing more water will mean we can operate safely at lower throughputs, or more readily at lower throughputs. But I ask you to consider, at the end of the day, managing declining flow, as you implied, is a very costly survival strategy. And even if we are able to move 300,000 barrels of oil a day safely, I ask if that's really a desirable outcome for Alaska and Alaskans.
Well, Mr. Barrett, just a question for you. And you know, there's been discussions on minimum flow in the past, but the facts we know right now, heat, wax, pigging, dealing with water, ice issues, all deductions under transportation and tariff in TAPS, which means Alaskans under ACES, and I'm not dogging ACES or supporting anything else that's on the table right now, but the reality of it is that Alaskans under ACES are paying more to ship less oil every day. Is that a correct statement?
The way I would probably frame it is the cost of moving a barrel of oil down the line as the throughput goes down is headed up. So the cost per barrel of moving the oil is going up as we have to do more to manage that. So the cost per barrel would be the way we would look at it.
Okay. Thank you.
So our people, you know, I characterize this as kind of Alaska true grit. They apply a lot of ingenuity. It's a lot of very tough, very hard work. They function very well as teams. They're doing their part, but I think they could use some help. And we need that help, the throughput, sooner rather than later. And I want to offer you a perspective to consider. From my perspective as a pipeline operator, more production from fields near to our existing infrastructure is highly desirable, because it can come online into the pipe sooner in several years as opposed to 5 or 10 or more years out in the future. Alaska has the oil. We have the existing infrastructure to move it, but the production, as you all know, is continuing to decline.
Yes, Senator Dunleavy.
You said something that piqued my interest. The pipeline, the entire system, was designed to do what it's doing right now. So over time, let's say OCS comes online in the Chukchi Sea, like some think it may, if the transport system is similar to what folks is currently saying, which would be a pipeline across the top of the state, you're going to have to heat that oil. You may have to heat that oil depending upon the volume by the time it gets to the actual TAPS line. Is that correct? The length of the new line?
It depends. We currently get oil coming into the line at 105 degrees. So it comes out at, actually, the different fields, it comes out at slightly different temperatures. But what's coming in the line right now is quite warm. The problem is the decline once it gets in the line. Most pipelines in the lower 48, if you look at them, are all below ground. TAPS is not. We're roughly half above ground, half below ground. And we're above ground because of permafrost and seismic considerations for the most part. But it exposes the oil flow to the brutal temperatures we get in northern Alaska.
So
we're in Arctic climate.
The dropping volume, the mass that used to hold that heat is dropping. And
it
so
is,
it's cooling off faster.
And the flow rate is much slower. So instead of taking several days to go from pump station 1 to Valdez, I think our latest numbers were about 18 days. So it's exposed to the cold. The declining flow means slower movement, more exposure to cold, more drop in the temperature.
One last question. One last question. Theoretically, you could correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going to make an assumption here, couching a question. But theoretically, you could continue to run this pipeline with decreasing oil volume to almost nothing, but you will have to replace that liquid with some other method to move. In other words, I guess what I'm saying is you could keep it going, but the costs are going to reach get to such a point that there will be nothing realized on the return.
So eventually you'll reach an economic limit factor, but I actually think it's more complicated than that. With our current configuration, and that's important, warm oil pipeline, gravity flow for the most part. We pump oil up the hill and it flows down. We think that we can, by adding heat and doing other things, and we're doing a bunch, manage the flow down into the mid-300 range, somewhere like that, but it will be more costly. We are evaluating whether we could change the configuration of the line to something like a cold dry flow, manage it more safely down to that range or even below. But I, as an operator, and my people, I wanted to make the point about the picking, my people live this every day. It is not as simple as some people might suggest. I heard suggestions that all we have to do is add heat and we're going to keep running this, you can do it forever. I can tell you as an operator, that will not solve the problem. Adding heat, as we're finding out, injects other complications. We have great people. We'll figure out how to manage it. There will be a cost associated with it, but it is not a simple equation. It's complex, and that complexity continues to compound. So all I'm suggesting is it is not a, there's not a simplistic answer. Can we run it safely down further? Absolutely. But in 2012, we operated at 99.8% reliability. That's pretty good for any pipeline operator. We had the safest year ever on record, and our environmental record was just superb. That 99.8% reliability is a reliable revenue stream to the state, right? It's constant, and it was consistent. We didn't have the shutdowns. Uninterrupted cash flow, as you might look at it. What I would suggest to you, and I can't predict it, we work it every day as well as we can. I would not bet that you are always going to see that uninterrupted flow in the future as this throughput decline continues. That, I think, is the reality. We're not going to take the risk of running the line, like I said, at the pump station, if we think it's going to result in a breach. System integrity is enormously important to us. We'll stop it. Maybe we'll into, with the cold dry flow, you could get into batch operations. Might not be consistent. We might reverse how we do work in the winter. It's just not a simple straight line equation, but my suggestion is it's real.
Mr. Barrett, just to clarify for folks at home, can you define a cold dry system?
We would take, yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. What I mean by that is we would, the system now is wet. The oil has water entrained in it. We would work to extract the water from the oil. We get about, it's down around, it's less than a percent, but it's less than 2%, but we would work to extract the water before the oil entered our pipe. We'd do it up on the slope or at pump station one. And then if that works, and if that doesn't cause us other problems with wax and other problems with our system, then we could consider operating without adding more heat, which, as I pointed out, is adding some cost but also some complication. So it means we take the water out, so we call it dry. The science on that is what we're evaluating now, and we're working pretty hard at that. But it's not, we've not closed the loop on that as to its feasibility and practicality on this particular system. So that's what we're working on.
Thank you.
I wanted to mention, the safety performance we had is industry leading. Reliability was very good. Environmental record was very strong. So in thinking about and talking with our people, I think this is instructive for the state. What we're talking about now is, I was coming back on a flight. I recently read this book by a former Navy SEAL, Mark Owen, about the raid on Osama bin Laden. And the title of the book is No Easy Day. And it's taken from the Navy SEAL philosophy, and kind of suggest that the only easy day was yesterday. And so with our personnel, even though we had a good reliability, safety, environmental record, that was yesterday. And to repeat that level of performance, we're going to have to deliver our best effort. We're going to have our head in the game. We're going to have to do things pretty perfectly. And it's hard, but we have to do it today and tomorrow. The easy day was yesterday. So I think our state confronts the same paradigm. The easy day for TAPS and Alaska was yesterday. And I think unless we change the paradigm, we're not going to be able to sustain what we've had in the past. So, Michelle, yeah, we have another slide. So this, I was trying to figure out how you have a challenging job. But this is the statue at the Valdez Marine Terminal, and it represents all the groups that came together and worked pretty relentlessly to build TAPS. Engineers and laborers and welders and surveyors and Alaska Native groups. And the statute reads, "We didn't know it couldn't be done." TAPS is Alaska's pipeline. It's ingrained into the identity and the spirit of this state. Our personnel will continue to do our part, and they're just as determined, by the way, as the original pipeliners. I'm glad this committee is doing its part. But I know the task is not easy. But we really need your support to get this right and move it forward for everyone's good. But I appreciate the fact the easy day was yesterday. This will take some hard choices, some difficult decisions, but it would really help us all if we can increase the production, the throughput that's coming down that line, and preserve its value for this state for years to come. Thank you, sir.
Questions for Mr. Barrett? Quote that we didn't know it couldn't be done, I love it, and I think it's Alaskans need to unlearn the thought that we can't do things. I think it's become somewhat rampant. But I very much appreciate your testimony, and we will have you back after we pass on Senate Bill 21. We're going to be looking at understanding some of those issues, and although most of us here are private industry folks, I think we want to identify if there are places where the state can help on some of these operational issues. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next to testify is Mr. Doug Smith, President and CEO of Little Red Services. What we tried to do in this committee is we wanted to sort of a cross-section of folks that are operating on the slope. Remember, it's TAPS throughput. We had 5 hours of public testimony. We've had other industry folks, and we've had the industries here. So Mr. Smith represents a different slice of North Slope production in life. And welcome, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Matucci. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee. And for the record, my name is Doug Smith. I am President of Blue Ridge Services. Probably more importantly, I have the privilege to be the president of the Alliance, the Alaska Industry Alliance. We are 600 companies, about 35,000 employees, and most of us are dependent on a successful tax policy and production of oil and gas in our state, along with other resources. You know, we've taken a lot of time to try to understand all the expert testimony. I spent the better part of the last 2 days reading through some of the most recent presentations by Econ One, PFC Energy, and others. And, you know, I think some of the – it's early in the process, but this committee's focused on production and TAPS. As we've heard from the Admiral Barrett, you know, when there is an interruption in the pipeline, that is a problem on the pipeline. But that interruption expands exponentially back to the North Slope. We have no place for the oil to go. We have to start freeze protecting hundreds of wells and pipelines where they freeze up. In 2011, when we did have the pipeline interruption, that's what my company does. We provide the freeze protecting capacity on the North Slope. And we barely had enough equipment and personnel with everybody recalled to protect those assets so they could be restarted when the pipeline was available. So the issue is not just in the flow of the line, but everything on the North Slope in the wintertime is subject to serious issues when that pipeline is down. So the throughput issue is big, but I think we all look at this as a bridge building opportunity. We're trying to build a bridge of production to get us to the future production capacity that we may see from offshore and other areas within the state. I don't think anyone expects to take the current known resource we have on the North Slope and turn it into a million barrels a day again. The reality of it is, I think most of us would see this to be a success story to stem the decline to either flat or much reduced from what it is today to give us the time window we need to get to the next resource to put oil into taps. Now, from service companies across the state, you know, I know this becomes an oil company-focused discussion a lot of times, but they have a resource to develop, and we work as partners to bring that oil into the pipeline. Without a healthy support service industry, it's not possible for us to capitalize on opportunities, whether we change tax policy or not. And we do have an exodus out of the state of a lot of resources of my peer groups. Our company's resisted, but we're getting a lot of pressure from investors to consider other oil fields where it's not in a decline state. If you look at the recent petroleum news, the number of new wells waiting to be hydraulically fractured and put on production in November jumped by 50 to 410 because of bad weather. That should be a statement about Alaska, but it's not. It's North Dakota. 410 wells waiting to be fractured and put on production. That's a small glimpse of what they actually drilled. You know what? We drilled that many wells in the last 3 years total. We're in a very poor condition of activity compared to our peers that are drawing talent and resources and capital from the service industry to outside of Alaska, and that drain is going to continue. We've got to follow the investments of the companies we do work for. So this is a risk we run. The longer we wait, and we're 3 years into this discussion about tax policy, the longer we wait, the more we lose, the longer to recover to take advantage of a different investment climate. So consider that. When you look at how much more time, how many more sessions do we have to make the best decision possible, it won't be perfect. This is a tough task, but a fair and equitable, durable decision of policy is needed, and it's needed sooner than later. And I think there's been enough expert testimony, enough profiling of where we fall in other tax regimes to give the legislators a lot of information to work with. And we are opposed to too many additional inputs. And you go back and you look at some of the original information provided by some of the other third-party experts. I go back to 2007 and look what was provided by Gaffney, Klein, and Associates. And what they forecasted for us back in 2007 was we were going to invest another almost $4 billion in CapEx for drilling alone up through 2012. We would see an incremental improvement in production of 200,000 barrels a day by 2012. Oil companies were somehow going to find 123% IRR, and everything was going to be fine under ACES. This is what was forecasted. You guys know the record. In 2012, we're here. We've lived it. This is so far off, it's not even in the same ballpark. So instead of speculating a lot more on what experts think, we need to look at what their track record is, what the investment capital is doing in our marketplace, and recognize that what we have to sell as Alaskans is a commodity called oil. And how are we going to bring that to market and keep jobs and our economy moving in the right direction? With that, I'll leave it with you for any questions you might have.
Yes.
Thank you. And I want to thank you, Doug, for your testimony and for following this issue diligently, almost like Senator Giesel does when she's not on a committee. You've been in the audience, present, and accountable for now 3 years on this issue. So I want to say thank you for that. My question for you is, this committee will be putting together a list of recommendations. As you know, it has a long way to go. On to Senator Giesel's committee, which a couple of us, three of us at least here sit, in resources for a more thorough analysis, and then on to the Senate Finance Committee. But at a minimum, out of this committee, there'll be a list of recommendations. And I would like to hear from your perspective, from the Alliance and oil field service companies, what would be some of the recommendations that you would have on the governor's bill at this stage?
Well, Senator McGuire, through the chair, here's our 4 points. Ensure that our tax policy adjustments do not increase taxes in the range where producers will stress test the economics of projects here. Now, we've heard lots of different numbers, but it's probably in that $75 to $85 range. That's going to be being discussed in boardrooms and economists inside these producers to decide where to put money. So we cannot see, in our opinion, tax increases or increased risk in that price range. At the same time, we do not want to disincentive development within the existing producing areas. I'm a little concerned about not recognizing that the bulk of our immediate oil is going to come from the legacy fields and not from new development. Real quick note on technology. At the previous public hearing, Senator McGuire mentioned about forgetting about the existing producing areas where technology is a play. Go back and think about when Alaska first started producing oil, what the anticipated recoverable amount of oil was from crude oil. We surpassed that original number billions of barrels ago, but only through investment, research, and new technology approaches to enhanced oil recovery. Our best opportunities are things like the new CDR3 rig, targeting additional pockets of oil out of existing infrastructure in the Conoco area. Looking at things like the Brightwater Polymer Program for British Petroleum, where we're injecting a new chemical polymer down the water injection wells to seal off under heat and temperature, seals off current water pathways to redirect water flood into new oil-bearing zones and bring up water through existing wells. But this is expensive technology to develop, research, development. But these enhanced oil recovery tactics are going to see us through to the next major source of oil through TAPS, which is likely offshore. So given that, we've got to be very careful about what we craft and how it impacts legacy fields. The policy needs to support new entrants like Pioneer and ENI. Look, when you look at the production scale, their amount of production is not that significant compared to the legacy fields. However, the amount of spend they brought to the economy has helped keep some service companies and other employees here working and viable for an opportunity to change the landscape in the legacy fields. If it hadn't been for some of their spend, some of the companies wouldn't be here today. They would be working outside of Alaska. So we need to keep that. We do need these guys. These independents will be an important part of Alaska's long-term future. It's like we've seen Hillcorp come into the Cook Inlet. These independents will be important in the long-term brownfield landscape of Prudhoe. And a new tax policy, look, we need to have Alaska competitive. But what I heard one of the executives say from an oil company, and he's honest about it, we shouldn't give up any more Treasury money than we have to compete for investment to make sure we get a long-term economic future. So it's a tough recipe, but we need to come up with a solution. And unfortunately, that's fallen to you legislators, and I appreciate your efforts going forth on this.
Thank you.
Cool. Anything else?
Questions for Mr. Smith? I have one for you.
Yes, sir.
Your business model is different than the others. Are you expanding outside of Alaska, Little Red Services?
In our business model, safety is of paramount importance. We heat up fluids sometimes to 150, 180 degrees. We put them downhole. And in that operation, we are heating things that can become quite flammable at those temperatures and pressures. And sometimes we're going downhole 2,000 PSI, 4 or 5 barrels a minute. The industries outside of Alaska and some areas, the emerging areas like North Dakota, are not as safety-focused as our state's oil industry is. There's been a lot of accidents associated with our business line in those areas. So, and until those operators embrace operational safety a little more, we're not a good fit for them. So, but those fields are maturing. Hess and others are now becoming significant players in North Dakota. And in all honesty, without a change in direction here, we'll have no alternative but to start spending capital and resources outside of Alaska. We've asked oil companies to spend here. We've asked oil companies to have allegiance to our contractors. We recently, as a company, decided to bring our manufacturing from Canada to Alaska. And we spent about $2 million to build a hot oil unit. They've been built for many years in Red Deer, Canada. this year, the first one we built in Anchorage, Alaska, in a small 30-man fab shop, and they'll keep those guys working. So we'll do our part, but we need action by the state and by the producers to make it viable long-term. But we're putting all of our eggs now in one basket with bringing that fabrication to here.
How many of your employees, how many employees do you have with Little Red Services?
148, and 98 of them work and live in Alaska. Out of the other batch, some of them were previous long-term Alaskans, now live outside, but we're running about 70% Alaska hire. And we work closely with NIT to identify people coming out with CDLs and hazmat and tanker endorsements. That's what we need for a starting point. And last month we hired two Wounded Warrior veterans from that group who live in Alaska, and they're now working for us on the slope. So we'll take all we can get.
Thank you, sir. Other questions?
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Before I introduce the next group that will be testifying, I want to remind folks this is a citizens' legislature. A lot of us have jobs. I happen to have one in the interim working for the company that will be testifying next. And what's most important to maintain the public's trust is that we gauge full compliance with the Ethics Act and avoid any appearance or perception of conflict. So what I'm going to do is to hand the gavel over to my co-chair, Mr. Dunleavy. I will engage in the discussion. However, Senator Dunleavy will be leading the proceedings.
Thank you. With that, could we have Scott Jepson and Bob Hendrick come up and please state your name for the record?
Yes, if you can give us just a moment, we'll load the presentation because I don't think.
Let's take a brief at ease. You guys up. In session 435, and we have Bob Hendrick and Scott Jepson from ConocoPhillips about to testify. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to come and speak before the committee this afternoon. For the record, my name is Scott Jepson. I'm Vice President of External Affairs for ConocoPhillips Alaska, and with me is Bob Hendrick, our Vice President of Finance. There are four topics we want to touch upon this afternoon with the committee. We want to talk a little bit about Alaska's production challenge, talk a little bit about investment considerations, particularly in light of Alaska's high cost environment. And we have some comparisons between ACES and SB 21. I know the committee's focused on throughput, TAPS throughput, but what's really impacting, I think, investment in the state right now is the tax structure. So we're going to spend some time on that. And then lastly, we have some observations that we'll conclude with. I know this committee, as well as probably every committee inside the building, has seen this plot. So I just have a few observations that I want to make about it. The y-axis on the left side follows that top black line that shows U.S. Lower 48 production. And the y-axis on the right side is the other three curves for Texas, Alaska's North Slope, and North Dakota. I think everybody's aware that over the past few years there's been a resurgence in production in the Lower 48. We've seen something occur that I think if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have told you after all the decades I've had in this business, there's no way we would see this kind of production increase in the Lower 48. So the question is what's caused it, and why hasn't Alaska seen the same kind of production increase. While these other areas have seen substantial increases, Alaska continues to rock along at about a 6% decline. Well, there are a couple of things that, you know, if you go up to about the 50,000-foot level, you can focus on. Obviously, there's a resource in the lower 48, and it's not just unconventional. It's not just the shale plays, but it's conventional plays as well. Technology has improved, particularly fracturing technology, to the point where some of these plays that 10 years ago nobody would have thought they could produce oil now produce substantial volumes of oil. The other thing that's happened is oil price has risen. Oil price has risen substantially in the last 5 years. And that's made a big that's been a big factor in the investment that we've seen in these plays. You can now produce oil from plays that haven't been produced historically, and they're economic. The other factor that's out there is the tax environment. There's an equitable tax environment in the lower 48 that does not discourage investment. Now you come back to Alaska. Alaska has the resource. Kara talked, I think, a little bit about the vast resource that we still have remaining on the North Slope, and I'll touch upon that in a moment. Technology has been a mainstay of Alaska's development over the decades. Technology has been one of the things that we've continued to operate at the high, one of the reasons we've continued to operate at the high rates that we see today. We've always been a leader in place in things like EOR and coil tubing drilling technology. What we don't have, though, is we don't have a favorable tax environment. The tax environment that we have in Alaska takes away the upside as prices increase. We've said this many times, and we'll have some slides in Bob's portion of the presentation, and we'll talk more about that. What that does is it offsets the high prices that we've seen for ANS West Coast crude. We also have a very high cost environment here. Our transportation costs are high, and our operating costs are high. And again, I have a slide that I'll come back to in a moment that will address that. I think if you were to change this mix a little bit, you could see more investment in Alaska, and you'd have a better chance at seeing that production decline either go away or become much less pronounced than we've seen over the last few years. This is another slide that emphasizes the point that Kara made in her presentation. When you take a look at where the prize resides, it's in the legacy fields. This is a slide that comes from DOR data, 2009 Department of Revenue data, that was forecasting production for the years 2010 to 2050. We'd like to update this using public data, but DOR doesn't present this kind of detail anymore, so this is the best we've got. But if you go back and just take a look at what Kara presented, she was talking about 5 billion barrels remaining in the known fields on the North Slope. This just compares the legacy fields with some of the smaller fields that have gotten a lot of attention over the years, Agurik, Liberty, which isn't in production right now, but Nakayachuk and Point Thompson. All these fields will hit, either will be or have been engineering feats and have taken a great deal of effort to get on production. But when you compare the forecasted production from these fields with what we see in the legacy fields is where the prize really resides. So when we talk about things that we can do to try to stimulate production or to stem the decline, the focus has to be as much as, if not more so, on the legacy fields than it is on exploration of some of the smaller fields.
Excuse me, we have a question. Senator Michicki?
Mr. Jepson, could you go back a slide, please? I've noticed this through all these discussions and haven't asked about it yet. Alaska's North Slope production is erratic in comparison to the other curves in the other states. Is that just a function of their long decline that eventually stabilized in a gradual increase, or is there some other factor that?
Senator Michicki, through the chair, Alaska has variable production on the North Slope in large part because of weather variation. Production is much more efficient in the wintertime, so we often see increased production in the wintertime. This last summer, we had not only the downturn due to the weather, but we also had major turnarounds. And you can't tell in this chart, but at different points in time here, we've had major fields come on stream, like the Alpine field and some other fields. Of course, Alpine's outside this time frame, but there have been some other fields that came online during this time frame that changed the shape a little bit. But a lot of this is a function, really, of weather and turnarounds.
Thanks.
Next, I wanted to talk a little bit about what goes into making investments in different basins. And this is a highly abbreviated summary of what we look at when we look at getting into new basins and making investments. The arrows on the right side are an indication of whether or not Alaska is favorable or unfavorable. If it's red and pointing down, that's unfavorable. If it's green and pointing up, that's a favorable indication. So when you take a look at exploration prospectivity, There have been a lot of exploration wells drilled on the North Slope over the years, and at this point in time, we just don't see the large fields that we look for when we look around the world at other basins. And that's pretty much true from the Brooks Range to the coastline of the North Slope Plain. That excludes ANWR. I won't make any judgment call on ANWR. And it also excludes the federal offshore. I think, as you know, we're getting ready to drill a well in the Chukchi Sea. We're trying to drill it in 2014. That's an extremely high-cost environment, lots of challenges. But we think the size of the prize is very large, and it also has a very favorable tax environment. We won't pay Alaska severance taxes on federal offshore acreage that's, you know, 80 miles offshore. Now, we do pay it if we get into NPRA and other federal places onshore. But one of the things that advantages federal offshore is the fact that it has a better tax environment. Costs is something else that disadvantages Alaska. The North Slope is far from market. It's ecologically sensitive. It costs just an awful lot to operate up there. And I've got some slides here in a moment that'll put some context around that. But when it comes to costs, development costs, Alaska's disadvantaged there as well. Cycle time is another area where Alaska is somewhat disadvantaged. From the time I decide I might want to drill a well in Kupar, particularly on a new drill site, like drill site 2S, which we're building in the southern part of the Kupar River unit, until we get first production, that's a matter of years. I can go down to North Dakota or down to Texas, and from the time I drill that well and it's completed to the time it's on production is a matter of months.
Excuse me, we have a question. Senator Gardner?
Thank you very much. Actually, I have two sort of different questions, and the first one, I guess, is if the tax changes so that that's a green arrow up, is that enough to overcome the prospectivity cost and cycle time adverse impacts? That's the first question. And the second one is, in terms of exploration development costs, what has the impact of the ACES credits been on changing the way that you think about those things?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, it is our contention that there are some things that we, the legislature, the people of Alaska, can change on this chart that would change the investment climate. And change of the tax environment is one of those. Also, compared, if you take a look at SB 21, it does make some significant progress on the progressivity side by eliminating it, but it eliminates the investment credits. And one of the things that the state could do is look at investment credits for new production, and that includes legacy fields that will level the playing field when it comes to costs and the cycle time that it takes to get things on production in Alaska. With regard to your second question, it hasn't been a game changer for us. So I can't really speak on behalf of some of the other new entrants that have come into Alaska. I probably defer it to them to tell you what they think the exploration credits have done for them.
Just in follow-up. Thank you. When you talk about leveling the playing fields on credits, under the current regime, would you consider them level?
I think if you were to eliminate progressivity under ACES and keep the tax credits, that would be a significant improvement in the business climate.
But not enough to change the cost arrow, down arrow, to an up arrow?
I think you change it to an up arrow, yes.
So under the current regime, it's an up arrow?
Not with progressivity. The tax credits that we get under ACES combined with the progressivity do not offset the very high tax rates that we pay.
Thank you.
So continuing down, we talked about taxes. I don't think I need to get much more into that. I think we've summarized that pretty well. But as we showed on the last slide, the legacy fields have a significant upside potential there, where if you can attract investment, I think you'll have the opportunity to either flatten the decline or level it out. So again, just kind of reemphasizing one of the points that I made in the conversation with Senator Gardner, I think there are things that the state can do, that this legislature can do to change this equation and put the balance more in terms of investment in Alaska, changing the taxes so it's a more favorable investment climate, and putting incentives in place, capital incentives, potentially expense incentives that will incentivize investment in those projects that add production, will help level that playing field when it comes to costs.
Question.
Senator Machicki.
So I see two factors. I mean, thinking about the purpose of the formation of this committee, there's either two or three arrows. There are tax rates under taxes and permitting regulatory environment under cycle time. What about transportation costs? Is that something that the state regulatory regime can reduce in any way that you can think of?
You know, Tom Barrett, Admiral Barrett, talked about transportation costs, and I know Alyeska has a very strong focus on trying to keep those costs as low as they can. When it comes to regulatory, in terms of setting tariffs, you know, they have their formulas, they have their process, they have their procedures, and I don't know that the state has much to say, particularly when it comes to the FERC. But I wouldn't preclude it being an area of investigation for the committee. I just don't know enough about it to know whether or not there's anything that could be done there that would reduce the real operating costs of transporting crude.
So if I can follow up, so it goes back to increased production reduces the transportation costs per barrel. That's the direct
absolutely
effect.
The tariffs are a strong function of throughput.
Thanks.
Continue, please.
This is a slide that PFC showed you all last Thursday, so I won't belabor it, but I think it illustrates very elegantly just the problem that Alaska faces when it comes to new investments. The bottom three bars on this graph show the cost structure, according to PFC, of operating costs and CapEx in Alaska. And we went back and looked at our own projects, and this falls within the ballpark of what we see for these types of projects out into the future. Then you take a look at the data they've collected for lower 48 opportunities, and Alaska is clearly much more expensive. If all else was even, you could go down to some place like conventional drilling in Louisiana and drill about three times as many wells as you could for a high-cost environment in Alaska. So that's what I mean when I talk about the playing field could be levelized through investment incentives in Alaska. All else being equal, where would you rather drill a well? Some place you can get two wells for the price of one and double the production? Or would you rather drill it in Alaska where you get half the production at the same cost?
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. And again, this is a question that maybe you can't answer, but I should have asked it the first time we saw the chart. But looking at the development costs in Alaska, I'm wondering if these costs include the ACES credits, because what we intended to do with that was to share the risk, encourage investment by having the state have real skin in the game at the front end and buy down the risk. So I'm just wondering if these are, you know, just the direct costs or if they're the costs that include the credits and the state participation, which is about $1 billion a year.
Senator Gardner, through the chair, I don't know, would you like to take that up?
Just for the record, my name is Bob Heinrich, the Vice President of Finance for ConocoPhillips, Alaska. I don't know the origin of the data for this particular chart. When Scott mentioned that we our actual experience is similar, when we looked at our numbers, we included the benefit we receive on the capital credits. The $1 billion in credits, you know, rough $1 billion, though, much of that is going to the explorers, so they're not actually in the development category. So when you carve in what's actually applicable for the development piece, it's probably less than half of that amount. But our numbers that look feel pretty similar to this do include the results of credits.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just a quick question. Why does ConocoPhillips report a greater profit per barrel of oil in the lower 48 than here in Alaska?
It
would appear to some that ConocoPhillips reports a greater profit margin on a barrel of oil in the lower 48 than here in Alaska. Can you explain that?
I appreciate the question, because our numbers that are published often are misused. And in fact, you're right, on an oil for oil basis, We achieve a much better profit and cash margin on our production in lower 48 because of the lower cost structure and the access to markets.
Thank you. Senator Gardner.
Would you say that Alaska offers good rates of return and strong cash margins?
I'll take the cash margin first. Cash margins we receive in Alaska are significantly less than what we're receiving in new projects where we're investing, such as West Texas, Eagle Ford, North Dakota plays. So our cash margin, the way we define that is taking our net income per barrel and adding back depreciation per barrel. So we when you do that calculation, we receive somewhere in the range of $33 to $35 at current prices here. and the opportunities we're investing in other locations are in the $40 to $50 range. So your rates of returns would be in similar differences.
Thank you. And another question for Mike. Are there projects or fields or developments in Alaska that you're specifically not doing because of the tax regime right now?
Senator Gardner, through the chair. As we spoke last year, when we spoke in front of, I believe it was Senate Resources, and we talked about the challenges that we see under ACES, we talked about one field in particular. It was Northeast West Sac. It's a very highly challenged development that requires new roads, new pads, new pipelines, over 100 wells to fully develop it. And what we said is that based upon the investment climate we have with ACES, we're going to do a piece of that. We'll do some of that. We're going to do the pieces that we can develop off of the existing infrastructure. When it comes to stepping out and doing the full development of Northeast West Sac, it's problematic under ACES. If you had changed ACES and had a better investment climate, that would change the opportunity to go out and pursue things like Northeast West Sac.
Thank you. Problematic under ACES, does that mean you're not moving forward at all, just waiting for a change, or?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, that means we'll take a look at it on a periodic basis and decide whether or not it meets the investment criteria where we have at that particular point in time.
Thank you.
Please continue.
The next slide that I have addresses what we mean when we say the easy oil is gone. We've said that. I think it's been kind of picked up as part of the lingo when it comes to Alaskan production. So let me just tell you how I define the easy oil. When I came up here in 1982, it was in the early days of Kuparuk and Prudhoe. We were drilling wells at Kuparuk that came on about 5,000 barrels a day. These wells were 100% oil, associated gas, no water. Over at Prudhoe, you saw wells coming on that had the potential to flow 20,000 plus barrels a day, all oil, associated gas, no water. The wells that we drilled were relatively straight, modest deviation for the kind of central pad development that we had in those days. Unfortunately, those days are gone. We've fully developed both Prudhoe and Kuparuk in terms of the initial spacing, and now what we're doing is we're focused on trying to get the oil that wasn't recovered or wasn't efficiently recovered in that initial pass of development. So this is what we call the challenged oil. And let me give you some definitions around what we mean by challenged oil. We're having to drill complex, very high-cost wells to go after and chase isolated fault blocks where we still believe isolated oil remains. You know, most of these fields are very highly faulted, and I think everybody in Alaska knows what a fault is. You can see it down at Ship Creek in Anchorage. What that does is it isolates certain portions of the reservoir from the water flood that we have or the enhanced oil recovery injection that we have going on from recovery. So we try to identify those through seismic, and then we come back and we drill wells, and we tend to drill now what we call multilateral wells, where we drill different legs out of a single well bore into sands. So we might target five or six different sands. In an example that we've used here recently at Kuparuk, we drilled an eight-legged well. We called it an octolateral. It's a very expensive well, really pushing the state of the art. Those are the types of wells that we're drilling these days versus the straight hole, slightly deviated wells that we drilled back in the early 1980s. We're also pursuing flank oil. This is oil around the edges of the reservoir. And when I was doing Kuparuk development drilling back in the mid-80s, and we're still doing the initial primary development and implementing water flood and EOR, if it was less than 15 feet thick, we didn't develop it. It wasn't economic. Now we're moving out into the sands. They're 10 feet, 11 feet, 5 feet thick, and we're developing those sands. And it's in large part because of the technology that we've developed since then. We can put well bores in these very thin sands in a 10-foot sand and stay there for a half a mile or longer. That's, you know, from my point of view, that's incredible technology. But that's the kind of stuff that we're doing now to get this incremental billions of barrels of oil that we've talked about. In order to get that oil, change the decline that we've seen, potentially stem the decline, we're going to have to invest more money here in Alaska. So we need a better investment climate to do that. The other thing, of course, is water handling. We're handling probably about three times as much water now on the North Slope as we are producing oil. That's just a function of how we're developing the fields. It's a way of maximizing production, but it's costly, and we're obviously spending a lot of dollars handling a product that doesn't really add anything to the bottom line. Water doesn't generate any money for us other than the pressure support that it provides to increase production. And then lastly, I think, you know, it's always good to put things in context. So recently we came up with an example that shows just how far $1 billion goes these days. I think it was Senator Dirksen who said, you know, $1 billion here, $1 billion there, pretty soon you have real money. Well, I always thought $1 billion was a lot of money. But what $1 billion gets you in Alaska right now has really declined. What I have on the top right-hand portion of this slide is a picture of the original Alpine development. In that development, we had 92 wells, two drill sites, production facilities, an airstrip, a road that connected the airstrip and the extra drills and the other two drill sites, and that cost us about $1.4 billion. Came on at about 80,000 barrels a day. On the bottom right-hand side is a picture of, I believe, the CD4 drill site, but that's pretty close to what CD5 is going to look like when it's built, and that's going to cost us about $1 billion, and it's going to be about 15 wells, capacity of maybe 21 wells when it's all said and done. It's going to be a relatively short bridge, a couple of pipelines, and some minor drill site facilities, and it's going to come on probably in the range of 15,000 to 18,000 barrels of oil per day. That's what inflation has done to us in Alaska. I saw one of your colleagues quoted in a publication here recently where he commented on how much the oil companies focus on costs, and we do focus on costs. The cost increase that we've seen on the North Slope isn't because we're not paying attention to costs, but it's because the demand for equipment, people, services, et cetera, that we've seen as all the focus has turned towards additional oil and gas development in the Lower 48 and elsewhere because of the price increase in these resource plays. So, in short, it just, I think, goes to emphasize just what kind of disadvantage Alaska is when it comes to the cost environment that we have up here. I'm pretty certain I could go down to Eagleford and drill 15 wells for less than $1 billion. Up here, we're drilling 15 wells and $1 billion and trying to make a go of it. So as you try to levelize the playing field with your tax environment, you have to take these things into consideration. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Bob, who's going to make a few comments on ACES and explain how it impacts our investment strategy. And then I think he's going to talk a little bit about SB 21.
I just want to run through a couple of slides on ACES to set the context. I know our focus is not the current tax structure, but it does help set the context. This chart has been around a little while. It represents the marginal industry share, or the marginal share both across industry, state, and federal governments, as prices increase under the ACES program. The bottom axis is the North Slope ANS crude price, and the vertical axis is the marginal share. And what the marginal share is the change in distribution of cash for every dollar increase in price. So the bars represent that distribution of that, how that dollar is split among the state, federal, and industry. The portion that's represented by the red, the state share, also includes the effect of royalties, property taxes, and state income tax, because those are additional items that are paid to the state. It really illustrates well the effect of progressivity. So when oil prices are at that dollar mark, then they go from a dollar to $1.01, with the marginal share received by the state and federal government at 80%. Only 20 cents on every dollar increase are actually retained by the industry. With that effect on progressivity, the producer receives less and less of each incremental dollar as the price goes up. And that's really what the black line represents. And the only reason it increases is because of the progressivity facet of the ACES tax structure. So as you get into even higher and higher prices, less and less of the incremental dollar generated by higher prices is retained by the industry. It's kind of an odd thing. The result just works the same way for both the cost savings, since we're a net. It's a net margin-based tax. Scott mentioned, and others have said, that we are rigorous in our cost management. But for every dollar we save in our operations, only 20% of that dollar flows back through our bottom line as well. So one point to note, we do evaluate projects across a range of prices. And so when you see the difference in marginal take at different prices, it impacts our investment on the investment decisions.
So I have a question. I think the senator sort of asked it, but another senator had a press release the other day, and I've seen that many times. He talked about the BOE
that Conoco earns a higher BOE in the state of Alaska than it does in the lower 48, and I've been confused by it. I'm a natural gas guy. So does a company like ConocoPhillips earn more here than they do in the lower 48 for a barrel of oil equivalency? And what does that mean for Alaskans out there?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, it's actually a follow-on to the question I think the chairman recently just asked. As I said, the numbers that we present do tend to get people confused sometimes. The underlying premise or result of that is the nature of our business. In Alaska, we're over 90% oil production, with only about 10% of our BOEs coming from gas, and largely that's from the Cook Inlet operations. In the lower 48, we're in excess of 70% gas and gas liquids productions. So when you're trying to compare the depressed price that we've seen in gas in lower 48 through the recent years, particularly 2012, and the lower price received per barrel on natural gas liquids to the oil price revenues that we receive from 90% of our business here in the state, it's really a hard comparison to make. So in fact, just on a BOE basis, when you're blending gas and oil together, we in fact do have a higher net income per barrel, cash margin, whichever metric you want to look at, here in Alaska. But when you're looking at just oil to oil comparisons, that equation shifts, and it's much stronger in the lower 48.
I think the salient fact to realize there is we're not investing money in natural gas in lower 48 anymore. That's not, when we talk about our increased investment in lower 48, we're not spending those extra billions chasing natural gas. We're using those extra dollars to go invest in places like the Eagle Ford and the Bakken and Permian, places where our margins are significantly higher than what we see here in Alaska. So that's the key metric to compare to. And this data does get presented periodically in the public domain. I think in the June 2012 analyst presentation that we gave, we had these various margins that explain why we're focusing on oil plays in lower 48 and we're not focusing on natural gas plays for the very reason that was just described.
Just a quick thought, it'd be helpful to see that broken out on a barrel of oil equivalency as opposed to, well, oil to oil, apples to apples. It's confusing to a lot of folks that have been looking at these facts for the last several weeks. So,
Senator Machicki, through the chair, I'll go back and see what we can provide. There are certain disclosure rules we follow, and I need to make sure it's what's been in the public domain before and push on what we can give in that breakout.
Thank you, Senator Gardner.
Thank you very much. And I'm sure you folks are aware that in our discussion about progressivity of ACEs when we implemented that bill, the idea was that as the tax rate rose high, a taxpayer could invest, make a capital investment, and not only did the state participate in that investment, but it brought down the tax rate on every dollar of profit. That was sort of the way it was supposed to work. Would you say that's had any impact whatsoever on ConocoPhillips investment decisions?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, as we mentioned earlier, the extremely high tax rate, and we've said this in testimony last year as well, that we see in Alaska, particularly the marginal tax rate, impacts our overall investment decisions for the basin. What ACES does is it really impacts your cash flow long term. We look at more metrics than just the standard economic metrics like NPV or rate of return or anything of that nature. We also look at the undiscounted cash flow that we're going to generate. And when we take a look at investments in Alaska, Alaska is really impaired because of the fact that once you've got that project online, then your cash flow takes a pretty significant haircut from there on out. So consequently, we're investing in Alaska at a moderate rate. We're developing the resources. We're developing the best of those resources. But it's not attracting the discretionary cash flow that we might invest here if we had a better investment climate.
Thank you. I'm not sure I understand if I got an answer. Is it the fact that you can reduce the tax rate, has that resulted in an investment that's been beneficial in reducing the tax rate?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, I'll try and address that again. Tax credits are taken into account when we run economics, but we also take progressivity into account. We also take a look at how these projects fare long term when we take a look at overall cash flow. So it is part of the equation, but it's not the only thing that we look at. You know, when we look at the tax credit, what that does is that reduces the tax that we pay, but it doesn't really impact the amount of capital that we require for Alaska. So we look at where we're going to invest our money. We take a look at the long-term cash flow that we're going to receive in Alaska. And while there's a benefit to the tax that we pay by investing more money, it does not offset the huge amount of tax that we pay on our base production.
Okay. One other question. Can you tell me what your hurdle rate is for oil investments?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, that's a confidential information.
Thank you.
Just a quick question. It's kind of a side. The as you mentioned, the gas is the price down south, and it's, the spread between oil and gas has grown, and it, who knows, it may continue to grow. Like I said, this is an aside, but is ConocoPhillips contemplating at all a GTL approach to monetizing gas?
Mr. Chairman, we are not currently pursuing any GTL options. Our focus right now, as I think everybody in this room probably knows, is we're working with BP and ExxonMobil and TransCanada to evaluate a large diameter, large scale LNG plant using ANS gas.
Thank you.
That's our focus.
Please continue.
On the next slide is a depiction of our talking about earnings. ConocoPhillips annual earnings over time, they illustrate the point well of the effects of ACES and progressivity on our corporate or company operations in Alaska. This shows ConocoPhillips Alaska net income per barrel over the 5 years that since ACES has been implemented. We'll update this again when our 2012 10-K information is published later this month. The top line shows the annual average crude oil price during that same time frame. So what you see from 2007 to 2011, oil prices rose from about $70 a barrel to almost $106 per barrel, an increase of about 50%. Over that same time, our earnings shown by the dark blue line only increased from $22 a barrel to $25 per barrel, but virtually flat. We don't make substantially more when prices go up. Instead, the state share actually follows the price increase. So due to the progressivity surcharge of ACES, the state share rose from the $27 to a peak of $51, almost a 90% increase. So we think that this upside, if more evenly split, would help create a more attractive place to invest. Next, I want to go walk through a couple of slides around our modeling of Senate Bill 21 and the observations. This graphic represents the producer's share, which is the amount of cash available after costs are deducted that are retained by the producers. It's essentially the inverse of us of the slides or information you would have seen from the state's consultants, which depicts state or the federal take. So this is from the producer perspective. Same types of calculations. There does need to be some care in understanding how the data is presented. The producer share calculations depend on a lot of factors, and including the cost structure you assume, the capital components, and they vary from field to field, producer to producer. Here we've used the revenue sources data to model an industry take from a producer, total producer's perspective. We understand it represents all producers who have a tax liability and at their aggregate level. We've also shown the results for fiscal year 2014 only, and this is as though Senate Bill 21 was in effect for the full fiscal year, although it is implemented, I believe, January 1, 2014. It's not a five-year average. It's not a full field life that had been used before. We chose the first year of the budget because, from our perspective, that the data gets less reliable as you go out in time. So 2014 is a period we feel pretty confident in terms of what the impacts will be. So what it shows of the two lines, the green line represents the producer share under Senate Bill 21. The red line represents the producer shares under ACES, with a crossover point at around $93. So above 93, where the ACES falls under the percentage, it actually represents a benefit to the producers, a higher producer share or keep under Senate Bill 21. To the left of $93, it actually represents a tax increase to the producers. So as prices get below the really not near current and lower prices, the bill actually presents a tax increase.
So what it really results is the investor evaluating the benefits of the higher producer shares at higher prices and the cost increases or tax increase at the lower price. It's an important aspect to us because when we look at projects, we do evaluate projects under a range of prices. So Senate Bill 21 provides improvements at higher prices but represents an increase at the lower. The shape of the curve of Senate Bill 21 is not really dissimilar from the other fiscal structures we see in the lower 48 producing states. But with the high operating cost environment we work in Alaska, from our perspective, this result doesn't really tilt the equation enough to differentially favor Alaskan investments. A couple of ways we can make that differential is flatten the shape of the producer take so that a lower tax increase is felt at lower prices, or look at expanding the incentives that support the legacy fields to improve the likelihood of additional production being developed.
Excuse me. Question, Senator Gardner?
Thank you. The very last line on page 11, it does not encourage investment relative to ACES in a downward trending oil price environment. Is that just part of the risk calculation, or does ConocoPhillips see the world in a downward trending oil price environment? Is that something that you're thinking about?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, it's really the complement to the third bullet point under Senate Bill 21, positive elements, which it does make Alaska more competitive at the $100 plus. So
thank
it's
you.
Not a perspective on what our outlook is.
Okay.
But in large part, as people evaluate their opportunities, they'll be using their lens on prices. To maybe walk through this.
I just have a comment that we need to reconcile. One thing Alaskans are going to expect is that we fully understand the effects of anything going forward, that we're operating with the right data. So I'm assuming that the administration who is present and the folks that are producing the various models will get together and make sure that we understand the true effects and data as we move forward. So, yes.
Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The consultant hired by the legislature is trying to make those reconciliations also to understand the model and how it turns. So we're awaiting that results, which is why we haven't seen the consultant back again. We'll see with numbers, hopefully once we've reconciled the models, so that when we turn a knob, that we'll be able to have confidence between the two models that if the legislature wants to go a different direction, that everyone, including industry, understands how those knobs turn.
We're having some graph discrepancies we're trying to reconcile.
No, we appreciate that. We think it's critically important that we can all calculate the same numbers with the same assumptions.
So please continue.
Let me walk through this last slide of observations from ACES. Primarily, the fact that progressivity takes away the upside and from prices discourages investments. The tax credit structure we spoke briefly about earlier, Senator Gardner, it helps reduce the overall effective tax rate, but it's not enough to offset the negative effects from progressivity.
Okay.
With Senate Bill 21, we believe it's a good step forward to set the stage for improved investment climate. It eliminates, by eliminating progressivity, it solves the problem of high marginal tax rates, and it certainly makes Alaska more competitive in a higher price environment. And by higher prices, I really mean ranges we've seen in the last several years, $100 and $120 range, not necessarily further off to the right on those charts. The flip side of that, though, is that today's prices and lower, as it's drafted, it represents a tax increase to producers that will discourage investments if your perspective is downward or you're in a downward trending market. And last, the elimination of the strong investment incentives does not result in really a differential tax structure to those we're seeing in other climates that have lower operating costs and capital components. The gross revenue exclusion is not broad enough from our perspective to incentivize the type of production you're looking to achieve. But no matter what you do, you need to include the legacy fields as part of that plan.
Questions from members of the committee? I've got a question. there's obviously a risk in whatever we do, whatever you do. It's just nature of the business. But I guess what I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, is if a certain fiscal policy is developed, it would encourage ConocoPhillips to invest more in Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
It's very important. So if the right fiscal environment is created, you will invest in Alaska, because there's fear that you will invest out of Alaska. You've heard that.
We have heard that, Mr. Chairman.
What I've just heard you say is that you will invest in Alaska. It's important.
Mr. Chairman, we certainly would if we had the right investment climate. Right now, we haven't seen that. That hasn't been proposed. You know, one thing that I've done is gone back and looked at, you know, the statements we made in relationship to HB 110. HB 110 addressed the progressivity issue. It didn't eliminate it, but it got rid of that high marginal tax rate. And on the incentive side, it actually added more incentives than what we see under ACES. In that environment, our chairman felt comfortable saying that we would do certain things. So I understand HB 110 is off the table, but, you know, what we do will be dependent upon the kind of tax changes that are made. And our current chairman, Ryan Lance, has said that he will do more if we see the right kind of tax climate in Alaska.
Thank you. Any questions for the gentleman? At this point, I'm going to hand the gavel back over to Co-Chairman Chickie. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any other discussion or questions by committee members?
I'm looking forward to
getting there. So he is a co-chair, partially parent. What I'd like to say is that committee members, if you have any suggested amendments related to throughput specifically on Senate Bill 21, they're due in my office by noon tomorrow. Remember, I say throughput specific because there'll be plenty of other opportunities, resources, and then finance that'll be dealing with this bill moving forward. But please get them to me by noon tomorrow. We'll discuss Thursday evening what we plan to do. If we are talking about a white paper with suggestions or a letter of intent or changes to the bill. So I do ask Alaskans that you stay engaged and involved. This is an emotional issue. One thing I ask folks not to do is assume where people are on these issues. I mean, that's just something that we've seen, and this is a very complicated issue. And I, where I am right now is I think this bill would need some fairly significant changes for me to support. And we'll see if that happens going through the process. But we do ask Alaskans that you stay respectful. We've had 5 hours of public testimony, and I think we've had some great participation by Alaskans. We've had the industry. We've had the agencies. And as we let it go Thursday night, if it goes as planned, on to the next committees, I hope this framed the discussion well, and then this committee will move on to other throughput issues that are more operational in nature. So with that, we're adjourned until 3:30 on Thursday, February 7th, right here in Butrovich Room 205.